Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your health and well-being and your total environment. For many years, as a reporter on health, food and the environment on the Huffington Post, Alternet, as well as in writing books and on a whole range of these topics and investigating and researching health quite extensively for over two decades, I, for many years, offered, you know, self-help advice, worked with experts who offered that, and counseled all the things that we can and should do to promote our health and our well-being. And about 10 years ago, I began to see that this is not quite enough. While personal inner work is really great, we actually need to look at what's going on in our society, both in terms of things that we might need to take action on, in terms of social choices that are going awry and affecting the health and well-being of our whole population, including ourselves, as well as choices we make about our habitat here on Earth. So I switched my reporting to kind of covering those interfaces, but it's really important to both see what's going on, to face up to how it affects our health, and also to understand the inner and outer obstacles to becoming engaged and taking action. My own deep background is very much, although I don't talk about this much, in the area of psychology, although very often on Connect the Dots you'll find activists, experts, authors, scientists, advocates, and a whole host of other people talking about the range of public policy concerns. Today we're going to be talking psychology and spirituality and the connection between them and the connection between how we flourish and how we're doing and what's going on in our world that challenges us both personally and all of us as living beings on this planet. And we're going to be talking with Jeffrey B. Rubin, Ph.D., the author of The Art of Flourishing. Before we go into that portion of the show, I want to urge listeners to like the Connecting the Dots for Health page on Facebook in order to receive upcoming radio announcements. With a new change in Congress, we're having some very crucial actions that will be coming up that people really may want to get involved in making their voices heard, and there's constant information, alerts, as well as announcements for this radio show on that Facebook page. So please do sign up, because there may be some fast-breaking actions on some of these new international treaties that we've covered extensively on this program. And please, if you're not up to speed on those, go look to the Connect the Dots archives and get up to speed. And now for today's show. I'm very pleased to have Jeffrey Rubin with us today. He has a terrific background for discussing and really getting into some of these issues. He is a practicing psychoanalyst and psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapist who also teaches meditation, integrating the Western psychotherapeutic and Eastern meditative traditions. And he's written books on that topic, how to do it, how to practice it. And he also is a sensei in a Zen lineage. So he really comes by looking at this cross point, the cross point between psychology and spirituality, which we'll be discussing today, from a very rich background. And I'm very excited to have him on the show. I first became aware of his work through a couple of articles and blogs he did, and I really love Jeffrey Rubin's unique ability to both look within and to look without at what's going on, what's affecting us, what's influencing us. I think we need more and more help for people. He does contribute, thankfully, to the Elephant Journal, the Huffington Post, and other publications, and you can also follow him on his website. So that's the kind of range of things we'll be discussing on today's show. Welcome to Connect the Dots. Dr. Rubin, are you there?
I'm there. Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Sure. It's great to have you here. The article that of yours that I first read was published in Truthout, and called the McMindfulness craze the shadow side of the mindfulness revolution. And, you know, it's kind of like if you are in conversation, you know, with more than just one group, you know, and this is true in many different ways in contemporary life, there are different, you know, kind of ways of looking at things. On the one hand, I personally know, and I'm sure many of our listeners know, many people who practice Eastern traditions, forms of meditation, mindfulness, many practice them themselves, you know. And at the same time, you know, those forms of practice do sometimes almost seem to tell us that, you know, through controlling our own mind, we can kind of control the world. And yet we see the world kind of going a bit awry. If we look at what's going on in the body politic, many people I know concerned about their own mental health and mental state, which I completely understand, and it's really important to pay attention to that, just don't even want to know what's going on in the body politic because it's just too upsetting and stressful. And because of this, very useful practices like mindfulness, you know, kind of have been used as a way of sort of blanking out or withdrawing from contemporary realities. You know, or maybe those realities are stated not to exist, or, you know, in the larger eternal view of life. You know, your thoughts on this topic?
Well, you're raising a great question. You know, I think it's a double phenomena. I think there's a mindfulness revolution going on. Mm-hmm. I think that mindfulness, we could think of it as the new yoga. It's everywhere, in hospitals, elementary schools, prisons, therapy, medical care. And I think it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. As I suggest in the article, I think meditation can promote self-awareness, greater compassion, greater wisdom in action in everyday life. And I also think there's a, like with most things, there's a shadow side. There are potential problems. One of them you're bringing up is the detaching from painful external realities. Another one is that I think meditation is not focused on meaning. In other words, in meditation, you pay non-judgmental attention to whatever you're experiencing, thoughts, feelings, fantasies, body sensations. The focus is on seeing that, feeling that, and then being open to whatever comes next. The focus isn't necessarily going into it and what I call translating or decoding the meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think this has a problem built within it, which is then, in an ironic way, meditators often, I think, don't do enough with what they experience, by which I mean mindfulness helps us be aware of more than we might be aware of if we didn't meditate, and yet I don't think we do enough with it because of the hidden agenda to not focus on meaning.
The hidden agenda? What hidden agenda?
Well, if you look at the origins of Buddhism, what we think we know about it is that the Buddha led a sheltered life. Mm-hmm. He lived within the palace compound, and he snuck out one day and he encountered old age, suffering, and death in the form of three different people. Mm-hmm. And he was shattered. He was deeply troubled by this. I think he may have been traumatized by this. And then he saw a wandering spiritual teacher who had a very peaceful face. And that night he left his family, the Buddha did, and he went on a spiritual quest. In other words, the whole Buddhist system is really based on getting beyond suffering.
Mm-hmm.
This is very, this is not going to play well in Peoria, as I say what I'm going to say next, but I think it's true. I don't like that agenda, and here's why. What are two of the most powerful social change movements in the last 50 or 60 years? Civil rights movement, women's movement.
Mm-hmm.
They were bottom-up movements. It wasn't Lyndon Johnson or Kennedy or a public official that led these. These were disgruntled citizens, people like you and I, who were suffering.
Mm-hmm.
They were suffering. They were outraged. They thought injustice was horrific. And then they protested, and then it led to something. So let's imagine a world where we could get rid of all suffering. We've also gotten rid of then all feedback about social issues that we need to be outraged about. So I think suffering is horrible. Pain is horrible. None of us want to suffer. None of us want to feel pain. But this agenda of getting beyond it or getting rid of it, which I think underlies the whole project, I think is not our best move.
Mm-hmm. That dovetails into another Huffington Post article that you wrote, and it's something I think a lot about as someone who has been in the media, you know, for most of my professional career, and looking at how our understandings and beliefs about things are shaped by the media. And that is the role of happiness, you know.
Yeah.
There are a million books promising happiness, you know, personal happiness. Of course, everyone wants to be happy, naturally.
Yeah. But
and there's also another dictum in the publishing and media world, which is, you know, we should look at market surveys, we should look at Google Analytics, and we should give people what they want. And what they want is happiness. So, you know, there seems to be, due to commercial drivers, a kind of pandering, you know, to a very natural human hope or wish, to the point, but, you know, then promising it, serving it up, pretending that you could serve it up and all of that, is really manipulative in a certain kind of sense, to manipulate what people think, what they seek, what they think is possible based upon that, you know, that wish to be happy. I'd love your comments on that.
Sure. You're talking about the article, I think it was actually in Truth Out also, The Unhappy Truth mm-hmm. About Positive Psychology.
Yes.
I totally agree with you. I think it's a disaster, I mean, an utter disaster. I'll try to explain it as clearly as I can. Martin Seligman, who we could say is the architect of the happiness movement,
for sure,
wrote in his book Flourishing, which is more recent, that happiness is a completely non-workable goal. He said it's not really measurable, it's fickle, it's vague. He says this, I think, at the beginning of his newer book, Flourishing, and I totally, totally agree.
His work has then been sort of dumbed down or used or kind of gone down a road that he did not intend, or is this a revision?
No, not at all. No, I think mm-hmm. he's completely into it. But I'll say more about that in a minute. No, but his, quote, new model, which he calls Flourishing, which is really essential to what they call the positive psychology movement, is really based on the same flawed, shaky foundation, which basically rip away the niceties. It's get rid of what you don't like and have more of what you like. Mm-hmm. It's totally fickle. It's totally solipsistic. It's totally narcissistic. It's a horrific foundation for anything. I try to offer an alternative in my book, The Art of Flourishing, and here's the way I think about it. Flourishing is not feeling good. It's living well, living with meaning, living with fulfillment. Yes, finding the best within ourselves, but also enriching the lives of other people and making the world a better place. For our friends, for our grandkids, for generations to come. And if you think about it really unromantically and honestly, flourishing doesn't always feel good. If I wash the bathroom of a neighbor who's in the hospital, that may not feel good, although I might be doing the right thing. If you jump in a cold body of water to save a neighbor's dog, it doesn't feel good. You don't feel happy, but you're living well. You're doing the right thing. So flourishing is a really different model than happiness, and I think this happiness thing is a disaster. And I think what too few people ask, Allison, is the social context that this occurs in. This occurs at a time when people are feeling miserable. So
right.
I really understand the impulse, and it's getting, I think it's getting worse.
Definitely.
Since this stuff was launched, you know, some years ago. But it's a completely understandable impulse. I don't think it's the best way to go. Now, let me be clear to anyone in the audience who's now fidgeting a little bit and feeling a little weird. I think a byproduct of living well, living for others, being the best you can be, a byproduct of that is you do feel better. But if you at first try to feel better, it's a very narcissistic enterprise. It's about me feeling better now. I frankly don't think that's what the world needs right now. I think we've had enough of that. we see where that goes, and we really need something else. So I think the happiness movement and positive psychology are disastrous. Another thing that I say in that article, Christopher Peterson, who I think was one of the architects of positive psychology movement, he said central to an image of positive psychology is intimacy, is the theory of intimacy. Well, how the heck can you have a workable theory of intimacy if you don't want to deal with negative feelings? Because guilt, sadness, regret, they're not all of intimacy, but they're a part of everyone's relationships. Right. And if we're not willing to see, this is the whole thing is built on these kind of foundations that no one looks at because of this addictive quest to feel good, which just isolates us more, makes us more narcissistic. And in Seligman's book, Authentic Happiness, he says he's a, quote, walking nimbus cloud. He calls himself a grouch. And he said, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool pessimist. And I'm writing a new book where I critique all this. It's a combination of the critique you saw of meditation, the critique of happiness that we're talking about now, and then some other things. I'm going to also talk about the self-help movement. It's a new book that I'm working on right now. And this stuff is just a disaster, but I'm not surprised that he's still like that because the strategies don't work. They're just sort of, they're bad solutions.
Right. I mean, I'm with you on all of these kinds of things, and it's actually close to my own writing as well because these are the things that keep us disengaged and not kind of cluing in to health, you know, and it's just absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with the terms narcissistic, solipsistic, why they're problematic, you know, or, you know, we may think a narcissist is some, you know, king-size ego out there, which it, you know, likely could be the case, but you know, we don't self-identify and, you know, recognize our own narcissism and all of that. If you could just kind of unpack
sure.
that a little bit for our listeners, I think that
sure.
would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I talk about this in lay language and down-to-earth language, not professional mm-hmm. language, in a blog called Doing Self Better. It's on my Psychology Today blog, Doing mm-hmm. Self Better. Okay, think of it this way. A very wise older yoga teacher, my first yoga teacher, once said to me, you know, yoga is a tremendously self-absorbed activity. So you see, if you think of all the millions of people out there doing yoga, it's wonderful. And I don't drink coffee. I start my day doing yoga. Yoga is my coffee. Yoga is what I use to wake up and also to tune in. And it also opened the world. But it is a self-absorbed activity. It's about my stretching, my body, my breath, whatever, you know, whatever dimension of yoga we're talking about. Meditation is the same thing. I don't think we like to look at this, and I think we clean it up. By narcissism, I just mean sort of pathological self-absorption. Me, mm-hmm. me, me. I think that what I say in the Doing Self Better piece is that that's a part of life. We're, I think, evolutionarily built to do that. Our immune system needs to know what's outside, what's inside, what's a dangerous invader, what's not. So we need a self-focus to nurture ourselves and to enrich ourselves and to live better lives. When it gets too extreme, that's what I mean by narcissism, when we're too self-absorbed, we cut ourselves off from everybody else. And I was at a party with some very, very well-to-do people in 2002. There were about eight people there, and I was there. One had been in Clinton's administration, one was a famous literary agent, one was a very famous person in the media. And it was as if 9/11, and this was in New York area, it was as if 9/11 didn't happen. I was astonished. And afterwards, I came up with this ethical principle. They're the sort of two opposite ethical principles. One is what I call going local, and the other is going global. Mm-hmm. Going local is my finances are fine, therefore the world is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with some of this spiritual seeking that we're talking about that's very, very self-absorbed is one could be very flexible in their yoga, but there could be a disaster going on in the world around us. You know,
right.
whether it's homeless or whether it's hardworking people that have just lost their jobs, that don't have any recourse, whether it's, you know, unfair labor practices, whatever, whether it's Ferguson, whatever it is, the right. Self-absorption is not what we need right now. Solid system, I mean, in a similar way. It's kind of enclosed within our own world. So we need
and we're all that to some we're all into that to some extent. You know, I just want to comment because I too have been a long-term yoga practitioner and all of that. Back in the day when it first began, meditation, yoga and all of that was, you know, the critique of it was that it was navel gazing. So back in the day, everyone had to kind of come up with arguments and justifications, and some of the teachers that people went to, you know, explained why it isn't navel gazing. And for example, if one's able to digest and deal with one's own anger, then, you know, there are less angry people in the world, for example.
Yep.
But, you know, it's really, but then that rationalization kind of became a hardened, received teaching that just proceeded over time without any revision based upon the feedback the world was giving us. You know, the 100th monkey did not produce, you know, a kinder world. As we've seen, it's gotten worse, you know, worse and worse, and really since over my lifetime. And, you know, and in terms of the, you know, so I think that we really, you know, if we're looking, we also have to look without and kind of test that. And, you know, it's not just that, you know, some wonderful teacher handed us a teaching, but it's like, does this stand the test of time? Does it need to be revived? You know, the whole nature of these ancient teachings also is, and or even medical findings, which change over time too. All, you know, many findings change and have to be revised over time. But we claim to be for science, but we're not really taking that open-minded attitude to get that feedback. I also just want to comment that in terms of 911, I had a friend, and also we, with some nurse coaches and health coaches, and I'm a trained health coach, we did phone calls for people who were traumatized at that time. And there were nationwide phone calls of people who either were there, saw it on TV or whatever, and we had trained coaches and support systems in place for people to call into on a daily basis. So we had someone who called in. It was actually a personal friend whom I, you know, told to call in, suggest that they call in. This guy had been right at the site. He had been there within, you know, the first half hour. He had to run. He was among people who were running. Police were telling people to run, and a whole bunch of people were running away from the area right as it happened, not knowing what was going on. When he got home in the evening, and this couple were long-term yoga practitioners, his wife said, "Don't bring that negative energy in here. I don't want to hear anything about this." And so, you know, this had a suppressive effect. He needed to be able to share and be supported in what had happened with him. And, you know, we're not talking about share it endlessly, replay it 25 years later. You know, we're talking about right as it happened, that week kind of thing. And, you know, to me, this was just like a shocker and actually the beginning of my questioning some of these things. I was like, how can this be, you know? And there's also a cross point because there you have a spiritual teaching. Let's focus on the positive. And then you have a psychological need that people have. And, you know, there may be a psychological hope to be happy, but there are psychological needs in terms of, you know, how people manage and get support for facing up to difficult things in challenging times like the present as well, so that they can do what you're talking about, which is have a life of meaning, participate, engage, and be able to face up to the challenges and the suffering.
Exactly. Look, I think that one of the things that's going on, if you watch people around weather right now, I'm thinking, you know, that where I live in the Northeast, there seems to me to be a panic and a lot of attention when there's a possibility of a storm coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And people will talk about it and talk about it and talk about it. I think, I don't know that everyone is in a post-traumatic stress disorder state, but everyone seems to me at least hyper-aroused and hyper-activated. And mm-hmm. Because I think we've had several cultural traumas, you know, and I don't know if we pay enough attention. Katrina, Sandy, the killings in Connecticut and the elementary school in Connecticut.
Yes.
And I think people don't have much more room. What I call in Art of Flourishing, the first chapter, inner space. It's all clogged up, their inner space. They can't, and so each thing becomes sort of one more. And I think another one, frankly, was disillusionment with Obama. I think that a lot of people had hope that there could be something different. And when it turned out, for a variety of reasons, the Republicans blocking him, and also I think Obama not showing much strength and fortitude, what happened was people were disillusioned. And I think so people are overwhelmed and disillusioned. There's really a total lack of faith, whatever one side of the political divide, total lack of faith in external leaders helping us. I mean, I think one of the only external leaders who has any respect is the Pope, and the Pope is actually acting in a quintessentially Christian way. I mean, he's being like Jesus in a certain way, not so much around abortion, but around the poor. And so people are overwhelmed, and they can't really handle much more. And then you see these ideologies of don't bring in negative energy, or it's too much, or be positive. We have to look at them, I think, in the context. But I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, Allison. I think it's tough for us to do it because, frankly, these things become almost cult-like. And you used the word science. A lot of it is actually bad science. So, for example, here's what often happens in meditation. I think the teacher will convey, let's empty your mind of everything and just pay careful, non-judgmental attention to whatever's happening. So the person does it. But then over time, if it's a weekend workshop or if it's a week-long workshop, the teacher, who's a Buddhist, starts to talk about Buddhist theory. Ceaseless change, no separate, autonomous, individual self. And then I think people begin, what I call when I supervise a therapist, listening for rather than listening to. So people start to look for confirmation of Buddhist theory. Well, another word for that is it's bad science. Good science tries to disconfirm what it believes in order to prove what it asserts, not find what it believes to confirm itself. So you see with some mindfulness stuff, with a lot of happiness, with a lot of positive psychology movement, you see trying to confirm. They keep saying, and the media plays into this, the Times plays into this, everyone plays into this, studies show. Mm-hmm. Well, there was a Brown researcher, Willoughby Britton. I mentioned her in the article, or I have a link to her in the article. She's at Brown, and she's a neuroscience researcher, and she's a meditator. And she says the meditation research has tended to be disastrous. There have been 17,000 studies, and so I think it was NIH in 2007 just said the quality is just disastrous. Now, I'm sure it's getting better, and there's better stuff going on since 2007. But science is another problem here. Science has become, in an age where we feel overwhelmed, Allison, I think one question to ask is what do we do? How do we unconsciously respond? And one way, frankly, is fundamentalism, because fundamentalism is a kind of pre-modern mentality. I know the truth, you don't, and nothing you say or do will move me. That's kind of what I call psychological fundamentalism. It doesn't just have to be religious. By my vision, Bush was a fundamentalist. I know the truth, you don't, and nothing you say will move me. So therefore, you can have fundamentalism anywhere. You can have it in therapy, Buddhism, positive psychology, happiness, but there's not a lot of critical thinking. That's what I'm leading to. There's not a lot of critical thinking. There's trying to confirm what we already believe, strengthen our little territory, which just creates more of a balkanization of the world, these sort of narrow enclaves. And then when you challenge it, people go ballistic. When I wrote that article in Truth Out, there were, I think, over 7,000 likes or almost 8,000 likes, and there are about 300-something comments, and I started looking at them, and some of them were just vitriolic. And you know what? If you don't agree with my argument, then, then tell me where you see that it's wrong. I'm very willing. I'm very interested in where I'm wrong, because it's the only way you really grow. It's not, again, it's best bad science trying to confirm, but a lot of them were vitriolic attacks, which just tells me that I touched something emotional that they don't want to look at. I touched their denying of the shadow side of meditation. You know what I mean? So a lot of it is like that. It's a self-confirming rhetoric, and people don't look at really what's the truth, and the world needs us to look honestly at what's the truth.
I couldn't agree more. We're certainly, you know, seeing things along very similar lines, and it's really great to hear your whole take on this. We're going to have a station break right now, and then we'll be coming back. So please, for more of this fantastic insight and conversation from Jeffrey B. Rubin, the author of The Art of Flourishing. So please stay with us, listeners, for the second half of Connect the Dots. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. Back with you again, Allison Rose Levy, here talking today with Jeffrey B. Rubin. He's the author of The Art of Flourishing. He actually blogs on a number of sites, Huffington Post, Truth Out, Psychology Today, and others. He's the author of the new book, The Art of Flourishing, and he also has his own website, jeffreybrubin.com. Do I have that correct?
No, drjeffreyrubin.com.
drjeffreyrubin.com, very good.
Dr.
As in doctor. Yeah.
Yes,
doctor,
but no
doctor
period after the R.
All right. That's great. drjeffreyrubin.com, where you can follow his blog, see his upcoming events, and look at, you know, look into his books, of which there are numerous ones. We've been having a fascinating conversation. If you are staying with us for the show and have come back in after the break, again, thank you so much. Please like us on iTunes and forward this to your friends who you think might enjoy it. If you're just joining us, you'll find the whole program, so you can listen to it in entirety on the Connect the Dot archives here in PRN a little later today and ongoing from there. I'm fascinated by this whole conversation. I just wanted to pick up with one thread of what we were talking about that you said near the end of our first half hour, which is a totalitarian mindset as a risk factor for our times. This is something that I have hardly ever said out loud, but which I believe, and I don't, you know, obviously we see people out there who, you know, I don't believe in climate change, you know, this is a big hoax. I mean, that's a very obvious example of it. And, you know, as someone who reports on environment and part of the environmental movement and all, you know, obviously we have to counter that, but it's countered very often with this sort of pro-science stance of, you know, we're for science and you're an idiot. You know, and I don't think that's actually the best counter-argument, because it can actually lead to not a totalitarian view in terms of climate science. I think that evidence is pretty clear. But, you know, a sort of rigidity of thinking where, you know, I'll attack anything that isn't, you know, strictly science, whether it's integrative medicine, which in fact does have a lot of science backing it, which I, you know, not everyone is so well informed about to even be commenting on, or, you know, as in spirituality, you know, I learned this, that all we need to do is, you know, calm our inner selves, and then the 100th monkey will calm the whole world, you know, or, you know, a whole range of other views. I mean, we could become very rigid in our thinking about almost anything. I recently was disturbed, you know, you mentioned in terms of the social causes that give meaning. Obviously, I've been part, you know, as anyone looking at the history of programs or my blogs can see, of the movement to protect our water, food, and earth from fracking chemicals and fossil fuel, you know, poisons and stuff like that for, you know, 8 years at this point. But, you know, but it's really, really, but recently I kind of mixed in because, you know, after Ferguson, after the horrible, you know, events with Eric Garner's death here in New York, the inability to hold accountable the perpetrators of these horrible murders and crimes, the rise in support of the black community, and then the next thing that comes into the public mind is the alleged bad behavior of Bill Cosby. And, you know, to me, watching the women, and the blacks, black communities operating kind of at cross purposes was a matter of tremendous concern. And that's not to say that, you know, if someone behaved badly, terribly, if that person could be brought to justice in the justice system, you know, that would be a fine thing to do. You know, I want to restate that again. But anytime I raise this topic, for example, among women, I frequently, and I'll say right up front, I'm not arguing whether I believe it's true or he did or did not do it. I'm merely saying this isn't the right forum in the media for determining it, and I'm concerned about, you know, how it reads in the black community to, you know, be promised some form of change in the criminal justice system that would prevent these horrible, you know, unatoned for crimes. You know, that are so prevalent, and then the next thing that happens is that, you know, a prominent black, you know, leader is being, you know, or individual is being targeted. You know, how is that going to read for blacks? And I'm very concerned about public emotions being stirred up to set communities that should be acting together and in alliance and supporting each other, in fact, set at cross purposes. And yet, in attempting to have that conversation, people couldn't hear it. Everybody just wanted to prove to me why he's guilty, you know, which I said, well, maybe he is. But, you know, I'm not like saying he couldn't be because he's a saint or, you know, he couldn't be a bad guy. I'm not saying that. But people couldn't hear it at all because there was such a strong need to prove, you know, that probably all the people who harmed and hurt them over many years, you know, should be made accountable. And then this one individual, maybe a terrible guy, is going to be like the poster child for that. Your thoughts? Tough question, I know.
Well, I hear you saying two different things, so let me take them one at a time. First, you were talking about science and now Bill Cosby. So let me try to respond to both if I can. So let's take the
science
thing.
Well, totalitarian mindset really is what I'm going at here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the totalitarian mindset relates to what we're saying about science, I think. So, or one form of it actually is this making a fetish out of science, making, you know, science everything. You know, I love science. I think science is wonderful. I think science is one of the West's greatest contributions to human culture. And science, which you could look at as proving and justifying what you claim and being able to test it and have a community validate that. I want to ask a question that no one seems to ever ask. Where in science is it proven that science is the only or royal road to truth? It's not. It's one way of human knowing. And right now, you see this all the time in the Times psychology articles or the Times therapy articles. You know, science studies show. Well, another form of evidence is just human experience.
Right.
And I personally don't want to throw out literature or Shakespeare or anthropology because it's none of them are scientifically validated, but they're all valid ways of human knowing. So that's the first thing I want to say about this. Now, the totalitarian mindset, let's talk about that for a moment before the Bill Cosby stuff. So I think that you have to ask what the totality, you have to socially and psychologically contextualize it. What is the totalitarian mindset an answer to? Well, I think it's an answer to a world that's just bafflingly complex, and people feel overwhelmed, and one of the ways they handle that is focusing on brain stuff. You know, this portion of the brain gets lit up when this happens. There becomes an addiction to brain stuff. There becomes an addiction to science, and another way is fundamentalism. And so the real problem, I think, is that people feel overwhelmed, not in touch with their feelings, as you said, often not allowed to express their feelings, or they express them, you know, insensitively in a kind of fundamentalist way. I know best and you don't know anything. So I just want to say that about the totalitarian stuff. Now, with the Bill Cosby stuff, I haven't been personally placing much focus on, you know, looking at it or sort of studying it. One of the issues, I think, is what we do with celebrities. I think we put celebrities on a pedestal. It's just another way of not taking our own rightful place in the world. It's as if we live vicariously through them, and they become more important than us. But they're just, you know, I've treated some celebrities. They're human beings. You know what I mean? They bleed, and they cry, and they deceive, and they're human beings. So one of the things is that what we see with a lot of stuff in the news, I think, Allison, is a lot of attention and venom placed somewhere. Freud called this, you could think of this as what Freud called displacement. So in displacement, one has a very difficult day at work, and one can't speak back to the boss because one's in a relatively powerless position, needs the job to pay for their kids' education, so forth and so on. And then they come home and the dog jumps on them. They love their dog, but they push the dog away. Or their spouse comes over to kiss them and they rebuff the spouse. We take what we're feeling in one area and we place it erroneously in another area. And I think that's one of the things that happens with these news events, that everyone gets all riled up about some of these news events and they don't have to focus on what they're really upset about, which is that they feel scared, overwhelmed, and nobody's in their corner. And I think that's one of the sort of context for everything. And so the other thing is, I think that we're seeing in public life a complete ethical breakdown. There's a chapter in The Art of Flourishing, a talk I gave at the UN some years ago, something like Embodying Your Values, Closing the Ethical Gap is the chapter title. And I think we're just seeing this everywhere. We're just seeing a breakdown, whether it's, you know, football players abusing their young, vulnerable kids, or it's male celebrities harming women. We're just seeing a kind of an epidemic of this. You know, an interesting question that young people sometimes ask when I teach, they think it was always like this. I don't think it was always like this. I really think it's not easy to prove, but I think it's really, ethically, it's just even worse. And I think one of the things, I've had the privilege of being in one or two really positive organizations. One was the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts.
Yes.
That's where I first started practicing meditation with Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. And, you know, they had few or no scandals there. And I think it's because the people at the top really had done work on themselves. An editor friend of mine says nobody wants to do the work. And there was an interesting clip of the Patriots football coach Bill Belichick recently, where he said just to his players, just do your job. And I was thinking that that could be a title that it would not be bad for everyone to follow. It just seems very hard for people just to do their job, you know, whether it's politicians or religious leaders, just do what you're supposed to do. But
yeah, the Supreme Court, several members of several of the justices did not show up for the State of the Union address because, you know, they're politically disinclined. I mean, the court is supposed to be objective. It always was objective. You know, they're not supposed to be taking a political stance of that type. And so I was thinking of that in relation to, you know, just what you're saying. And what would young people think? You know, the degeneration of, like, that ethical space. And young people seeing that would think, oh, well, that's a normal. I mean, it's always been that way, which, in fact, is not so.
I think that's really true. I taught a course at Union Theological Seminary some years ago, and it was on flourishing, and maybe of course it was actually staying sane in an insane world, but it was based on what became part of the book, Flourishing. And they argued that things were always this way. And what I realized afterwards was one of the worst things, one of the things we should be most enraged about the people in leadership roles, is that they're doing an incredibly harmful and dangerous thing, which is they're leeching hope from the young.
Yes.
And this is one of the lifebloods of democracy, is the idealism and the energy of the young. And we're not setting a good example. And, you know, I always go back to family metaphors. You know, what would you do in your own kitchen table? This is not the way I hope many people would want to, you know, lead their own families. And it's not the way to lead a democracy. It's a living disaster.
So, you know, I think people know, and through reading your book, The Art of Flourishing, they can learn more, you know, to kind of contemplate these cross points and some of the things that they can do in their own lives. But since that's what we always do, is tell people what to do exactly in their own lives, and obviously everyone is feeling very overwhelmed, what can people do on the meaning side from your perspective? Like, how do they connect with that? Not that it's going to, how do they deal with the overwhelm so that they can connect with that?
Well, that's a great question. Look, I think one's life is defined by what you care about. And I've been very influenced by Aristotle. That's actually where I got the title. Flourishing eudaimonia is a phrase from Aristotle. I define it differently than he does, but it's really living, and he calls it living and faring well, F-A-R-I-N-G. And Aristotle talks a lot about ends, it's ends that matter. The ends or purposes of something. Let me give an example. Let's say you have the finest Stradivarius, the finest violin in the world, just the most well-built violin in the world. Who should it go to? In one of his books, Michael Sandel, the political theorist from Harvard, uses this example. Who should that wonderfully built violin go to? I mean, some would argue it should go, right now many would argue it should go to the wealthiest citizen. Mm-hmm. It's a no-brainer for Aristotle. The way you figure it out is, what's the purpose of the violin? Well, the purpose of the violin is to play beautiful music. Therefore, it should be in the hands of people that can play the most beautiful music. In other words, the end of something, the end or purpose is what determines how to live. So from that perspective, there's a wonderful line in Eric Hoffer's, the book I read in high school, True Believer. He was a longshoreman on the West Coast, a sort of philosopher longshoreman. And he said, you can never get enough of what you really don't need to make you happy. Let me repeat that. You can never get enough of what you really don't need to be happy. So from my perspective, one of the arguments that I don't think anyone makes is that all this rapacious greed and corruption, it doesn't even serve the people that are involved in it. See, most people want to say, well, you're hurting us, but someone who's going to operate in that kind of greedy, corrupt way doesn't care. They have no conscience. But the argument I would make is, to them, they're betraying themselves. Why? Because if we think about Aristotle and ends or purpose, what's the end or purpose of life? Is it to accumulate as much as we can? Well, for Aristotle, it's a no-brainer. The answer is no. Why is the answer no? Because what do you do with that money? Well, you do something else. You have more vacation time, or you spend more time with kids, or you buy something, or you know what I mean, or you own something. So there's something beyond the money. And then if you look at that, well, why do you buy something? Or why do you, you know, want vacation? There's always something more. And Aristotle would ask us to struggle with, what is the true end of our existence? What's the true purpose? You know, is that kind of...
That
saying went years and years ago, you know, you can't keep your toys after you're gone. And so we don't think enough about the ends or purpose. So I think whatever we care about shapes our lives. And if we care about making the world a better place, if we care about leaving the world a better place for people after us, if we care about helping those that we come in contact with, if we care about actualizing our own potentials, this is a very different existence than if we treat the world as an amusement park that's designed to just serve us and please us, which is what I think a lot of people are doing right now. You know, there's an interesting cultural drift towards narcissism. When I was a kid, people would say, I want this. Now, if you listen closely, young people will say, I need this.
I need it, yeah.
I need it. As if you don't provide it, you're abusing me. You're denying me of something vital. You're not denying them anything vital. You're denying what they want. You're denying what they desire. So I think we have to become aware of this as it lives in ourselves, and we have to see if we can care about things that are more ends rather than simplistic goals.
I think that's really it seems so obvious. And there are all these kind of business books, you know, that say, you know, what's your vision, you know, come up with your game plan, you know, all of that kind of thing. But that's also extremely short term, you know, these short term business defined goals. So you're really talking about looking at more meaningful long term goals. You know, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because in the social policy sphere, I am always basically arguing that if we did that as a society, we wouldn't be doing so many of these things. We wouldn't be risking the habitat of life on Earth due to fossil fuels and climate change, you know, for a bottom line of the next quarter. That's very, very, very short-term thinking, you know. And we do that consistently, but what you're pointing out is it's also embedded in us as individuals to do that and not to really think about the long term, not just purely in financial terms, but in meaning terms.
Yes, and the other thing, you use the word financial. The other thing is, and I may talk about this in this new book, I think we need to expand our sense of what prosperity means. Mm-hmm. I think we have an incredibly narrow and economic-only sense of prosperity. gross national product. And you see, one problem that really scares me, in some other countries, they're starting to play with widening that, and they're using some of this happiness stuff. But I wouldn't use happiness stuff. I would use genuine flourishing. How do you help a culture flourish? How do you help the young in the community flourish? How do you help the animals flourish? How do you help the earth flourish, the soil? Do you know what I mean? So we need to break out of these narrow and really unsustainable images of prosperity. We need a new American dream.
Yes, yes. I totally, totally second and agree with what you say. I mean, in fact, I think one of the large, I think it was a Gallup or something like that, they went around the world, you may be acquainted with this, and they, you know, they were seeking a happiness index, you know, and then they were like, oh, cool, now that we know what this is, then we can supply it and we can make changes like, you know, have big companies put in an exercise room, you know. And it's kind of like, hey, you know, if we have like 50 years before the Earth could be uninhabitable, then that's not the kind of big change that we should be, you know, getting together in big conferences and, you know, thrilled to pieces that companies are looking at, you know, to improve, although, you know, obviously it's a minor quality of life improvement for those who are involved, and of course they'll argue that increases productivity, but it's still extremely shrunken heads and you know, short-sighted and tiny picture. I mean, actually, it's really interesting. I've thought a lot about this all in terms of being myopic. And, you know, how do you get people to look at the big picture? And I think your strategy of looking at long-term goals is really, really important. Now, I just want to do a segue here, and then we'll kind of come back and finish the show. This is a, I had mentioned at the beginning of the show that we had some upcoming actions that are rather critical. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to alert people to sign into the my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health, or my personal page, Allison Rose Levy, because we have some timely actions coming up, I said, but we didn't know when, on the upcoming trade treaties, which would basically put international corporations through treaties, would be able to supersede American law. Anything that you or I or American citizens vote into practice, you know, could be superseded by these treaties. We didn't know when they were going to be voted on in Congress. Apparently, that's now been determined, I learned from an email I just received, and it's going to be January 27th, which is next Tuesday, which is before our next Connect the Dots program. So I'm asking all listeners listening to this, and if you're listening to it years later, hopefully we all did the right thing in terms of long-term thinking, to either Google Trans-Pacific Partnership and find organizations that are involved in this, or you're welcome to come to the Connect the Dots page, as I'm going to Connecting the Dots for Health page on Facebook, as I'm going to post a lot of information about how you can become involved. You know, I ordinarily wouldn't do this kind of stop the presses thing, but I think it's very important in this instance in terms of long-range thinking. I've really just been, you know, bowled over and thrilled to talk here today with Dr. Jeffrey Rubin, the author of The Art of Flourishing. And you can go to his website, drjeffreyrubin.com, learn more by his books, follow him on the various sites where he writes and blogs. And, you know, I think also both in terms of really asking those questions that you were speaking out about, you know, those long-term questions about what we're really seeking, what we're really about, what matters most, can give a direction and also give us something to kind of hang on to and help us connect with other like-minded people and groups who share our values, you know. Very often, I know in all kinds of studies they show that people are influenced by the people around them. So, you know, if you're hanging with a crowd that values certain short-term or unsatisfying things, the kinds of addictions, common addictions that Dr. Rubin mentions, you know, if you align with a higher purpose, you can also connect with the people. And by higher, I don't mean spiritually sainted. I mean, you know, your most meaningful purpose. You can also connect with other people who share those values, and you can build community around that. Your thoughts on that, Dr. Rubin?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And something I say in Flourishing is that things are worse than we believe, and there's more hope than we know. I really believe that. Things are worse than we believe, and there's more hope than we know. And I think we access that genuine hope, Allison, when we express the best within us, and then we help those around us.
Well, this has just been, terrific. And actually, when we had when we were communicating prior to the show, I had not received, and I have yet to receive, your book, The Art of Flourishing, which I look forward to receiving. And I heard from your publicity team during the actual program, and I'll be getting that. We had said that, we wanted to go ahead and do the show anyway. I'm glad we did. And you also mentioned, maybe you'll come back on another time and talk specifically about your book. And I certainly hope you will, and want to reiterate that invitation. I'm also thrilled that you're doing yet another book on these topics. I think it's really important and helpful. And just thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Allison. Great talking to you.
Great talking to you. And thank you, listeners, for being with us this week on Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. So tune in again next week. Come join me on my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health, to take action. Very timely this week. And have a great week, and be well, and find your sense of higher meaning, your sense of meaning, what gives you purpose, what you really most deeply care about and want to be part of creating in this world.